This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture and I'm Sumitra Selvaraj. The spiciest of Malaysian conversations often takes place over our shared love for food, but are there topics that are off the table? What we eat, where we eat and how we eat our food are questions that are easily answered as long as there is no peppering of religious and racial sentiments. But can we separate the inferences from the ingredients? We speak to Preetha Samarasan, who put together a series of these conversations where food and politics converge for the Asian American Writers Workshop.
Yeah. What I wanted to know was the idea behind tapao, how it came about and why it's housed where it's housed.
Yeah. So basically, when my book came out, which is like more than 10 years ago now, when my novel came out, I was living in the U.S. I had just finished an MFA program in the U.S., and so I had this connection with the Asian American Writers Workshop, even though I'm not Asian American, but because I was an Asian, I was a person of Asian descent living in the U.S., they, you know, got in touch with me. Mm. I did a reading there and since then had kept in touch with them, you know, on social media a little bit. And so I guess in the last, let's see, when did they actually get in touch with me? It was a while ago, maybe 2 years ago. Mm. The then director of the Asian American Writers Workshop got in touch saying they had this project called the Trans-Pacific Literary Project. Basically, it's like the Asian American Writers Workshop reaching out to Asia, to, you know, writers who are not Asian American, but just Asian. And as part of that project, they were putting together a series of, well, what they called folios.
Okay.
And it was a very flexible idea. Like it could, basically they tried to get together interesting thinkers, like not necessarily just writers, but just interesting thinkers to explore a topic. And it's very loose. It's very open-ended. It could be anything. Like I think they had one, the one that was just before tapao, I believe was the subject was plastic.
Okay.
So I don't know how they came up with that, but they asked if I would be interested. This was also just after GE14. That's right. So it's quite 2 years ago, but just after GE14. And you know, Malaysia was in the news a lot. Malaysian politics was in the news a lot on people's minds. And so they contacted me and said, hey, would you like to be in charge of putting together one of these for Malaysia and something that reflects in a way the current moment, the political moment that you guys are at this time. So I said yes. I jumped at the chance, but I didn't know what sort of topic, you know, what would be what would allow both, you know, what would be open-ended enough and yet allow sort of deeper conversation. Mm. And of course, you know, thinking about Malaysia, very quickly you start thinking about food because every conversation in Malaysia sort of finds its way to food. And I've been interested in that for a long time, how it works. It kind of works. What I've seen is that it mostly works in the other direction, is that we'll start out talking about something, you know, quote unquote sensitive, maybe what people would consider sensitive or a little risky. And then either as a kind of protective instinct or defensive, you know, mechanism, people will say, oh, it always sort of finds its way to food. People will say, well, let's talk about food. Or even without saying so explicitly, people will start talking about food, which I think, you know, maybe I'm simplifying a little, but sometimes I do have the impression that we do that because it's the safe thing, because we think, well, here's something that brings us together. We're not going to disagree about this. We can all, you know, we can have a conversation that will preserve the peace.
Like the weather for the Brits.
Yeah, a lot like that. And so I thought, I wonder if we can push at that a little bit. First of all, to take it in the other direction, if we started with food and if we had the right, well, you know, right for me, it's very subjective, but if we had the right people, mm-hmm. would we be able to kind of push this in the opposite direction where we start with food and find our way to a deeper, more political conversation? Because actually food is very political. And anyone who's spent any time, you know, thinking about it in any context, in any country, knows that, of course. I'm not saying anything, you know, groundbreaking or new. Food is very political. But I think Malaysians in the mainstream, you know, people think of like, oh, well, let's not politicize food. Let's not politicize art. They say this about all sorts of things that are inherently political. So I thought, well, let's do this from the other direction. Let's start with food and let's sort of take it apart and see the ways in which it is political, and let's see if it can be used as a sort of a conduit into a deeper political conversation. Now, how I got from food to tapao I think it had something to do with, I think right around that time I had been talking with a friend from India, and she had pointed out that it's not really so much a part of Indian culture. Like you might go out to eat, certainly, mm-hmm. but you don't bring back, you know, they don't have the tapau culture that we have in Malaysia. And that for so many reasons. I mean, one thing is that, of course, for middle and upper middle class families, you know, labor is cheap in India. And so you have someone making the food at home.
Mm.
You don't need to go out and get that fast, convenient meal and bring it home. So I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, and then I thought about all the different ways in which, again, tapau is sort of this, what it means culturally, like what it, whether it is political, whether it says something about us as a culture, how it's developed, the history of it. I thought, well, maybe this is a way to narrow down that extremely broad topic of food. And maybe this is something that hasn't been investigated as much as, you know, just Malaysian food in general, or our home cooking culture, or our eating out culture. Maybe those are things that we talk about more. But tapau is something I feel we all sort of take it for granted. We all do it. I don't know any Malaysian who doesn't, you know, tapau food. And yet I don't see it being talked about specifically, except in, again, quite superficial ways. Like, here's what I tapau today, kind of, you know, and then the conversation ends there. So yeah, that was sort of the genesis of it.
Okay, so let's go back to something that you said right at the very beginning, the fact that, you know, Malaysians do politicize food, but perhaps don't admit to it. In what ways do you think that Malaysians politicize food?
Well, I mean, just on the most basic, obvious level, of course, something that came up very quickly in all of the conversations, because what I did was, you know, the way that the folio works is that you divide people into small groups and then we're each having our own conversation. And something that came up quickly and repeatedly was, of course, religion, because religion does what we can eat and what we can't eat is a divisive thing in Malaysia, you know, whether what's being served is inclusive and who can eat what and when they can eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And this, yeah, I mean, I think it comes up, you see it coming up more during the fasting month.
Yes.
But I think it's always kind of there under the surface. And I think, you know, I've seen a big change talking with my parents too. I know that there has been a big change in the last, you know, however many decades of Malaysian history, to where we have gradually developed sort of quite separate food cultures,
mm-hmm.
Because of that, because of religious restrictions and because of the way that they've been perceived, I guess, because of the way they've been interpreted, where before Muslims would quite happily eat in non-Muslim houses, in non-Muslim homes, and even in non-Muslim eating establishments. You know, you could go, people would go, I mean, when my dad was in school, his Muslim friends would go, they would all go out to eat together, and there would just be certain things that they wouldn't order, but everyone else would order, you know. But now you see that happening less. So I think that's one thing that when we talk about food, we sort of, again, we try to smooth it over. We say, well, of course, we'll, you know, we'll make sure we'll, or, you know, I see this happening a lot. Someone will post a photo on Facebook or even Instagram. Someone will post a photo of a particular food, and then they'll apologize quickly for saying, oh, sorry, it's not halal, as though the act
it's
of
a picture.
Posting a picture of a non-halal food could somehow offend someone. And maybe it does, but this is what, you know, sort of blew my mind. I mean, just how, on the one hand, how explosive of a thing we think it might be. And is it really, or is there a way to talk about that, or is there a way to question that or challenge that? So yeah, that was one thing.
One of the environments in which what you've just talked about is, for me, most apparent is in schools. When I went to school here in Malaysia in the 80s, the idea of a potluck party was very, very popular. My classmates would bring dishes from home and everybody would eat communally. I understand that this is something that is not really encouraged anymore in local schools. And I think that's a shame. I think it's a real shame. Was that something that you experienced going to school in Ipoh?
Yeah, I mean, I think I feel like I saw a change through the course of my my school years.
Mm-hmm.
But for Children's Day or whatever, class parties and things like that we would have, certainly, yeah, we would bring food from home.
Mm.
And it was understood that if if your parents or whoever's going to cook something from home, of course it never had to be stated explicitly. Like, you made something that everyone would be able to eat.
Correct.
So you stayed away from pork and beef, because those were the two things, you know, Hindus wouldn't eat beef and Muslims wouldn't eat pork. So generally you made something, you know, chicken or something vegetarian, and you brought it in. And no one, I remember in primary school, I don't remember a single person ever saying, well, is this okay for us to eat? Mm. Is this, you know, can we be sure that it was made in the right sort of kitchen? No one, even, you know, going from the students right up to the teachers who were adults, no one questioned it. It was never any problem. But I do remember that gradually in secondary school, actually, there was this one canteen day where the teacher, one of the teachers, so canteen day was a thing where the food, often whatever we were selling, if we couldn't make, if it was something too hard to make, it would be catered. We would buy it from some kind of provider and then sell it, I think. Mm. So there was this idea that our class was going to sell fried chicken, and the class teacher knew someone who could make it, you know, in a large enough quantity that our class would sell it, and she was going to arrange it, and it was all sort of decided. And then somehow this rumor started. The class teacher was Chinese, I should say. And this rumor started, and I don't know where it started, but suddenly the Muslim girls were all worried. They said, well, it's Chinese chicken. And can we sell it? Can we buy it? If we're selling it at school, well, can the Muslim girls buy it and can we eat it? And I remember that was really the first incident that sort of opened my eyes that this could be a thing. And I thought, what? But it's, you know, it's chicken. Like, it seemed, and a few, it was even within the sort of the Muslim community, Muslim girls at school, it was divided. You know, some people said, oh, let's not make such a big deal of it. Mm-hmm. We've never worried about it before. But there was like a quite vocal minority that was saying, no, we don't know. We should make sure. Like, let's ask her to get the chicken from a Muslim vendor instead. Mm. And, you know, to be honest, I don't know how it was all settled. I don't know if the teacher said, you know, come on, let's get over it. I don't know, because we were kids and she was the adult. Maybe she managed to, you know, resolve the conflict in some way, especially given that she had already ordered it. So I don't know. But it was I mention it only because it was the first time I noticed something like that. And then gradually over the course of my secondary school years, I did notice more and more, like, there would be worries about canteen food suddenly. Or there was this sudden rumor, that those things called satay sticks.
Yes.
Which were not in any way satay. I mean, I think it was fish-based.
Mystery meat.
Yeah, mystery meat, chewy, tasted a little bit like sotong, you know, like the dried sotong on a stick. But suddenly there was a rumor that that was pork. And I remember that too. And then gradually, I think when I was in Form 4 or Form 5, I remember once a friend, and this is like on a different level, because I remember what happened was that she, it was after school, it was quite hot, it was a very hot day, she shared her water bottle with me and was sort of pulled aside and chastised by her friends. And so I remember, like, you know, the series of things, of course, which all the things I'm telling you, there were years between them.
Of course.
So I'm constructing this quite neat narrative for you, which is not how it happened. But now that I look back, it, you know, it's sort of cumulative, this series of things that was kind of changing the way that I perceived these relationships and the safety of friendship and how much we could trust and how much we could take for granted. So that's a long answer to your question of whether I remember. I mean, I think it was much less than it is now, but those were a few things that I remembered sort of in the later part of my school years.
I'm speaking to Preeta Samarasan about tapau, a series of conversations about that most Malaysian combination of food and politics. We're going to be taking a short break now. You're listening to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Sumitra Salvaraj. I'm asking writer Preeta Samarasan her thoughts about the cultural heart of Malaysian food, and we're having this chat because Preeta facilitated a series of conversations on this topic for the Asian American Writers Workshop. So over the course of the last couple of decades, it's perhaps clear that racial lines, cultural lines have been applied to food that we once considered communal, that we once considered Malaysian. This politicizing of food doesn't only happen on a Malaysian level. On a regional level, we wage wars, food wars, over claiming who, what belongs to whom. That's probably one point where you do see Malaysians united over a dish that they will claim to be their own. But what are your thoughts on the politicizing of food within a region? Like, for example, I take the Nusantara region, you know, where we share what I would say is a very, very common heritage.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And that's what I was about to respond. You know, I think that in some ways, these boundaries that we've erected between, say, Malaysia and Singapore, that's the one I can think of, where there is a lot of resentment because basically Singapore has more money to promote their food culture and to publicize it abroad. And so we perceive it as, oh, well, we have that and it's better here and it's better in Malaysia, and yet they're getting all the credit for it. Well, okay, I can see some truth to that. I can see why there's that resentment. But at the same time, I think all of these national boundaries are so recent in Southeast Asia. And it is, as you said, more useful to think about the Nusantara region. Like, we are this historically, you know, we're one region. Therefore, we share culture. And it seems sort of, yeah, it seems fake. And again, yeah, just arbitrary to say, well, this is Malaysian, this is Indonesian, this is Singaporean. It just doesn't work that way. Nothing works that way. Certainly not food, but not even, you know, language or history. So I think, you know, part of me wants to blame sort of this new, I think the reason there's so much contentiousness is because of this temptation, because of the way culture works now. Like, oh, let's go and, you know, and, you know, somebody's entering MasterChef, or somebody has a lot of followers on Instagram, or this person's getting a lot of, you know, public recognition for this. I think that this has created an atmosphere of competitiveness where maybe there wasn't as much before.
Mm. Do you believe in the concept of a national dish, one dish to unite us all?
No, I think I find that quite ridiculous, actually, because never mind. I mean, I'm trying to think, would it be possible in a more homogeneous society, like in Malaysia, the minute you say, like, what's our national dish? Well, the question is going to arise, like, should it be a Malay dish or an Indian dish or a Chinese dish? Or what dish do we have that brings all of those together? Mm. Which I think, you know, I think all of our cuisine, a Malaysian Chinese dish is not what you're going to find in mainland China. And the same with an Indian dish, you know, Malaysian Indian dish has, we've borrowed from, the cultures have borrowed from each other and used, you know, different spices, different influences. So I think it's going to, but nevertheless, that whole thing will come up, like, oh, well, of course, it's going to be a Malay dish. That's that's the national dish. And then the Indians and the Chinese, not to mention all the others, will be feeling resentful of that. So, But I was thinking, yes, is this possible in a place like, say, well, say like France or say Japan, to say, okay, this is our national dish? But even then, I don't know. I'm hesitant to get behind that concept because it sort of suggests that it suggests a static aspect to culture that I feel is not true. Like, can you change, once you declare something the national dish, how often can you revisit it or change it or say, okay, we've sort of, you know, moved away from that now or something else? I think I just have a reservation against declaring something the symbol of culture, because culture is fluid.
And speaking of fluid, what are your thoughts then on foods that are inherently associated with a culture being kind of, I don't want to say appropriated, but kind of sliding into other cultures? I'll give you the example of muruku. We now have a Malay kueh called maruku, which sounds exactly like muruku and looks exactly like muruku. But if it is muruku, why wouldn't you call it muruku?
Right. Yes, I saw that when you know, people were first talking about it in social media. Like, have you had it? Have you tried it? I'm so curious.
No, I assume it's just muruku.
I mean, I'm so curious because I wonder, like, did they change anything? Like, do they have their own take on it? Like, is this? And I mean, again, it's impossible to talk about any of this without invoking the balance of power, the history of Malaysia, the way that these communities have interacted with each other, and the feeling on either side of what has been given and what has been taken, and whether it has been perceived as equal sharing, or whether, because of the history of Malaysia, one community feels, well, there they go again, taking from us when we're not treated as equals, when we're not given, you know, the same credit for the things, you know. I think it's impossible to, in an ideal world, if the playing field were level, then sure, you know, make your maruku and hopefully it's a slight twist on what we had and you know, you, by all means, make it and sell it and, you know, acknowledge the inspiration for it, if you will. But given that there is no ideal world and given the history of Malaysia, of the nation state, I think, no, there's no way to avoid the fact that people are Malaysian Indians who see themselves, I mean, among the three major races in West Malaysia. I should always, you know, we always sort of tend to gloss over the fact that things are very, very different in East Malaysia. The whole question of ethnicity and the specific ethnicities are different. But sure. In West Malaysia, Malaysian Indians, among the three major races, feel themselves to be on the bottom rung. And that, I think, has to be taken into account when suddenly the dominant majority is making something. And the posters that I saw that said, you know, I think I saw like some kueh making class or something, and it said, come learn how to make these Malay kueh. And muruku was on there, and maybe a Malay version of Adarsan?
Yes, correct.
And I have to admit, like, I felt a little sting just because in nowhere was it stated that this is our take on this other thing that existed first. So I think that's key for me, you know. I think what distinguishes cultural appropriation from an equal sharing is partly that, like, just acknowledge, just say, oh, you know, we really love this. We thought it was wonderful. And here we are, you know, kind of making it our own and adding something or changing it a little. But we know where it came from. And that if you don't do that, especially if you are favored by any historical balance of power, then things are going to get pretty tricky.
As a Malaysian Indian, what were some of your own food influences growing up? Was it a very Malaysian Indian diet?
No, but again, I don't know. I don't think we were atypical in that sense. You know, our food at home was quite chinchai, quite a mix. You know, there was some. I mean, I think my parents cooked in a way, even among their siblings, I think I saw more sort of purist, what I think of as purist Indian cooking in the extended family, whereas my parents were more likely to attempt a Chinese dish after eating it at a restaurant or just, you know, try different things. I remember my mom once seeing a recipe for ayam gole in the Star newspaper and saying, let's make that. So no, we didn't have a very typically Indian diet at home. It was very much mixed, and when we went out, certainly we almost never went out for Indian food. Being, you know, given the fact I was growing up in Ipoh, we lived in Ipoh, we almost always went out for Chinese food because what was the point of going out to eat what you were eating at home? So no, I wouldn't say. And it's interesting now when I have cravings for home food, what I think of as home food, when I'm homesick in a foodie way, when I'm longing for the food of my childhood, it's actually almost never what people would think of as purely Indian food. You know, I don't find myself craving dosa in Italy as often as I might char kway teow or tai si hor fun or, you know, sort of the Chinese hawker food that I grew up eating.
So then and I'm going to use the term that we use very commonly in Malaysia, did Western food creep into your diet as well then as a child?
As a child, a little bit, but really, yeah, probably not as much as Chinese food, a little bit. And again, you know, when you say Western food in Malaysia, I feel like you almost have to ask what you mean by that. Do you mean the Malaysian Western food as in chicken shop, which does not exist?
Right. So I was just going to get into that, this whole idea of Malaysian Western food and European Western food.
Yes. So Malaysian Western food, I do actually love. It's not something I'm going to eat every day, but I do love it from time to time. The chicken chop and the pork chop, the Hainanese pork chop. And I think it's its own thing. And I don't look kindly upon people from the West who come and say and sneer at it and say, well, this is not real. I mean, it's not trying to be real anything. It's Malaysian. I think of it as quite Malaysian. So since I've lived in the West for so long, I guess the question is, has actual non-Malaysian Western food crept into my diet? Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, a little bit, you know, just because some of it is just quite easy to make for a family, you know, things like pasta and certainly things that I see around me, things that I've tried and I find easy to incorporate into the family diet. Yeah, I would say they've crept in, and I don't always spend the time to, you know, make quote unquote authentic Malaysian food.
So we've talked a little bit about the politicizing of food and how we think about food sometimes along racial lines. Did how you ate your food ever kind of creep into your thoughts? Did the fact that you ate with your hands, or that you were comfortable eating with your hands, was that something that kind of you mulled over at any point?
After leaving Malaysia, yes, because in Malaysia, I don't remember ever. I mean, I won't say I never thought about it, because it's sort of, you know, it depends on the context, right? In Malaysia, you might eat with your hands at home, but you might eat the same food with a fork and spoon outside. And maybe sometimes it's partly, you know, convenience. Am I going to find a sink easily to wash my hands? And certain types of food, of course, depending on the type of food, like, you know, when we went out to eat char kway teow, we didn't eat that with our hands. But it seemed like a more a decision based more on functionality or convenience or practicality in Malaysia. After I left Malaysia, yes, then I started to think more about this act of eating with the hands. When I make Indian food and I think, well, I really want to eat this with my hands, this is the kind of thing that would almost be spoiled by cutlery. I want to eat this with my hands because of that comfort and that familiarity, and I do think things taste differently when you eat them with your hands. So, and then I started to think about the context in which I was comfortable eating with my hands and where I just can't do it. I won't do it. And really it comes down to, I will eat things with my hands in the privacy of my own home. Actually, I can't really, I mean, of course I'm not talking about like a sandwich or something that everybody else is eating with their hands, but if I'm going to eat rice and curry with my hands, yeah, it's going to be in my house. And it's also because, well, I mean, I remember this incident where, I think this was before I had children. I was at someone's home for a dinner party, and they had a young child. The child was maybe 4, I would say. And, you know, to be honest, I don't remember what they had served at, but maybe some kind of pasta or maybe, yeah, something where, for whatever reason, the child was finding it difficult to use her cutlery and began to use her hands. And all of a sudden, the whole table of adults turned and began to scold her, to say, you can't do that, we have guests. And I remember this word being used. It's really just a French word for rude. That's disgusting, that's rude. They said, c'est cochon, you're eating like a pig. And I remember just feeling really, and I had not touched my food with my fingers at that meal, of course, because it was like, I think it was pasta, so linguine or something like that. So of course I was eating, you know, very properly with cutlery. But I remember being taken aback by this statement that eating with your hands was disgusting, and it was very boldly put. There was no, like, you know, it, there was no, so it sort of in that moment I thought, wow, what am, you know, when I have kids, what am I going to teach them? And so I've made it a point with my own kids, and just generally when I talk about it, to always say it's about the context. You know, basically you do as others around you are doing, and if someone else in the group is doing it differently, you never say, as an objective thing, that's disgusting. And I've tried to teach them the same about food as well, that you don't say, this is not nice, this is not tasty. You just say, I don't care for this, this is not what I prefer. This, you know, no thank you, I don't want more, but you, without sort of casting aspersions on someone else's taste. So the act of eating with my hands, or even just eating different food, I think I can't even talk about myself as part of a minority, because really I'm the only brown person. No, that's not true. I have one neighbor who's from Cambodia. I've not discussed this with her, but really we're not even significant enough to be a minority. We're two people, you know, in the village. So I think that really influences how far I'm able to go in terms of pushing boundaries, and how far I'm even able to talk about the fact that I don't eat the same food as you guys do at home. Because the times that it comes up, like if I were to mention, yes, actually, you know, I eat rice with my hands at home. And it's just the effort of explanation. And first of all, sort of having to, what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of having to manage the surprise and is just too much labor for me. So much of the time I choose just to fit in. And the times, it takes a special situation or a But it takes, I suppose, strong feelings on my part to sort of come out of that and, you know, to make the effort to say, actually, you know, I don't eat bread every day at home. I eat rice, and sometimes I eat it with my hands. And
Are your children comfortable with eating with their hands?
They like to. I don't know. When you say comfortable, do you mean are they skilled at it? Because then the answer would have to be no. They're not very good at it, but they really like to.
Yeah.
And they're often asking to. And they often, especially in Malaysia, they always want to eat with their hands. They want to do, well, it's like, you know, wanting to be like everyone else. And so in Malaysia, if that happens to be eating with their hands, and I will let them, of course, you know, in Malaysia, there's no problem whatsoever. I say, yeah, go ahead. But here, because they're not very good at it, it's so, you know, I will only again say, I think our rule has become, we can do this at home and nowhere else are you going to eat with your hands. They really like the idea of eating rice with their hands, but they just, you know, and I never thought about this growing up, but it actually does take, it's interesting. When I was growing up, I thought about using cutlery as the thing that needs special skills. You have to learn how to use a knife and fork. Mm. And I never realized that you actually have to learn how to eat with your fingers.
That's
right. It doesn't come naturally, eating rice with your fingers.
I remember some years back, I took Sashi, my husband, out to a very fancy dinner in KL on account of his birthday. And it was one of these new fine dining restaurants that had opened, but it was an Indian fine dining restaurant. And, you know, it's your usual 16, 20 courses, takes you on a journey through the Indian diaspora. And the food was beautiful. One of the final courses was a stunning lamb biryani, and it was served, and I just looked at my plate and I started eating with my fingers, and there was nobody else in the restaurant. It was a small restaurant. Nobody else was eating with their fingers. Yeah. And the chef came up to me and he said, "I'm glad to see you eating it with your fingers." He said, "It's the right way to do it." He said, "From now, I'm going to suggest to people that they should do this."
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah.
But this idea, this notion of being yourself with your food in unfamiliar surroundings is perhaps something a lot of us grapple with.
Yeah, it's a tough one, and it has so much to do with how you perceive your position, you know, in the setting, in the context, like whether you, I think it's such a delicate thing, like whether you have the confidence to do that has to do with how you perceive yourself in relation to the other people there, I think.
Mm. So in these conversations that you're having through tapau, through these folios, what do you hope to achieve with them?
Well, the project is over now. It's all done. You know, it took so much longer to wrap up than I thought it would. But in a way, that was a good thing, because our thinking and our way of talking about it, I think, evolved over the course of the time that we were working on it. At least in my group, there were some long delays, you know, in communication, and in the end, I think it was a good thing. But as for where, it's a thing that's finished. It's over and done with. Where I hope it took us, first of all, and then will take the people who read it, is to think about. I mean, it's interesting because we started with this. You know, here's an interesting moment in modern Malaysian history. Let's see if we can sort of grab this moment and talk about it. And in the end, the things that we ended up talking about, or the, if there are any truths that emerged, they weren't true of only that moment. I mean, I think we sort of hit upon more generally, it feels like a project that is not going to be dated very easily. Like a lot of the things we talked about have just been true for a long time and will continue to be true, I think. So I think rather than providing a way for a non-Malaysian audience to think about this moment in Malaysian history, I would hope it provides some insight into who we are as a people, as a culture in general. And really what I when I agreed to the project, the main thing that I said was, I'll do it on this one condition, which is that I don't have to mediate this for an outsider audience. I want this to be a conversation between Malaysians. And I want it to be a conversation for us, among us. And that if you want to listen because you're interested, that you just sort of listen and not expect to be centered, not expect to be taken by the hand and led through this. So I hope, really, that's what I hope. That's what I hope it will do, and that's what I hope it will take non-Malaysian readers, you know, sort of give them the chance to do this. And in the end, of course, nothing ever works 100% like you imagine. There were some moments where, particularly in the talking about race, because it was for an American audience and because the my editor, the person above, well, not she, I was working with an editor who was American, and so I would have these conversations and then she would read them and sort of give me her feedback. And there were a couple of times where she was uneasy, actually, with the way that Malaysians talk about race. And she would say that it seemed it wasn't clear to her. For us, it was clear when we were talking about race in this way, it was clear where we stood on the questions. But for her, it seemed like we were sort of almost buying into the stereotypes that we were questioning, or that we weren't questioning it enough, you know, things like this. And when she put it that way and I brought it back to the group, then the group would say, well, that's, you know, we didn't know if that's how we wanted to be seen by an outside audience. So ultimately, you can't get away from the fact that, yes, you're having this conversation, even though it's not addressed to this audience. The audience is there. And their perception is a real thing. And they're going to hear you and they're going to form thoughts about it. And so it's, you know, you can't get away from that. So there were one or two moments where we did say, okay, how is this going to be perceived if we use this racially charged word, even though we know we're saying it in quotes, or we're saying it ironically, or we're saying, you know, is an American audience or a non-Malaysian audience going to know this? There were one or two moments like that. But other than that, this is all sort of a big caveat to say, okay, there was one or two moments where we had to sort of make it a little clearer where we stood. But other than that, I hope that it provides the opportunity to provide this quite immersive experience, you know, sort of you're dropped in with very little explanation. And I think that it's quite rare for a non-Malaysian audience to have that kind of insight or experience of Malaysia.
Okay. So on that note, where can these conversations be found?
On the website, I'm sorry, I don't have the link right now to read out the address to you, but they can be found on the page of the Trans-Pacific Literary Project, which it has its own thing. So it's sort of separate from the Asian American Writers Workshop, and they have their own page with all of these folios. So the one before us as well, which I think was from Laos, I think, and then you'll see the Malaysian conversation.
So I think the website is aaww.org. That's the Asian American Writers Workshop website. And then if you just search for Tapau, that's two words, T-A space P-A-U, you should be able to find the full list of conversations. And all that remains to be asked is, what's on the menu for dinner tonight?
What's on the menu for dinner tonight? Oh, my goodness. Now you're being like my mom. She's always saying, what have you cooked? Have you cooked? What have you made for this? What is on the menu for dinner tonight? You know, I think I have some prawns in the fridge, and I think I'm going to make some kind of nasi goreng. Some prawns and some greens, and it's very much going to be cobbled together, not at all an authentic. Is there such a thing as an authentic nasi goreng?
No, there isn't.
when I say not authentic, it's because the greens that I have are actually rocket leaves, which do not belong in nasi goreng. But this is what I mean when I say I just, you know, take the ingredients I can find and make something with a familiar flavor to it.
And that sounds like the perfect note to wrap up on. Thank you, Preeta. Thank you so much
Thanks so much for including me. And yeah, it's great to talk, as always.
I've been speaking to Preeta Samarasan, writer and she who tapaus, about the rojak that is Malaysian politics, culture and makan. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn segments, you can download the podcasts on our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.